Yes, she thought. Yes, now, now, do it, do it. Take me, fly.
John. Author, announced Jeremy Riker. The underdog. And this one was J for Flowers. He turned the corpse over with his foot, and the dead white face stared up at the overcast sky with blue, blue eyes. They were Ben Sock's men, both of them. My uncle's men, John thought, numbly. He remembered how he'd pleaded to ride with them. Gods, I was such a green boy. If he'd taken me, it might be me lying there. Jaffer's right wrist ended in the ruin of torn flesh and splintered bone left by ghost jaws. His right hand was floating in a jar of vinegar back in Maester Aemon's tower. His left hand, still at the end of his arm, was as black as his cloak. "God's heaven mercy," the old bear muttered. He swung down from his garron, handed his reins to John. The morning was unnaturally warm. Beads of sweat dotted the Lord Commander's broad forehead like dew on a melon. His horse was nervous, rolling her eyes, backing away from the dead men as far as her lead would allow. John led her off a few paces, fighting to keep her from bolting. The horses did not like the feel of this place. For that matter, neither did John. The dogs liked it least of all. Ghost had led the party here. The pack of hounds had been useless. When Bass, the kennel master, had tried to get them to take the scent from the severed hand, they had all gone wild, yowling and barking, fighting to get away. Even now they were snarling and whimpering by turns, pulling at their leashes, while Chet cursed them for curs. "It's only a wood," John told himself, "and they're only dead men." He had seen dead men before. Last night he had dreamt the Winterfell dream again. He was wandering the empty castle, searching for his father, descending into the crypts. Only this time the dream had gone further than before. In the dark he'd heard the scrape of stone on stone, and when he turned he saw that the vaults were opening, one after the other, as the dead kings came stumbling from their coal-black graves. John had woken in pitch dark, his heart hammering. Even when Ghost leapt up on the bed to nuzzle at his face, he could not shake the deep sense of terror. He dared not go back to sleep. Instead, he had climbed the wall and walked, restless, until he saw the light of dawn off to the east. It was only a dream. I am a brother of the Night's Watch now, not a frightened boy. Samwell Tarly huddled beneath the trees, half-hidden behind the horses. His round, fat face was the colour of curdled milk. So far he had not lurched off to the woods to retch, but he had not so much as glanced at the dead man either.
"I can't look," he whispered miserably.
"You have to look," John told him, keeping his voice low so the others would not hear. "Maester Aemon sent you to be his eyes, didn't he? What good are eyes if they're shot?"
"Yes, but I'm such a coward, John."
John put a hand on Sam's shoulder. "We have a dozen rangers with us, and the dogs, even Ghost. No one will hurt you, Sam. Go ahead and look." "The first look is the hardest." Sam gave a tremulous nod, working up his courage with a visible effort. Slowly, he swiveled his head. His eyes whitened, but John held his arm so he could not turn away.
"Sir Jeremy," the old bear said gruffly, "Ben Stark had 6 men with him when he rode from the wall. Where are the others?"
Sir Jeremy shook his head.
"Would that I knew."
Plainly, Mormont was not pleased with that answer.
"Two of our brothers butchered almost within sight of the wall, yet your rangers heard nothing, saw nothing. Is this what the Night's Watch has fallen to? Do we still sweep these woods?"
Yes, my lord, but
do we still mount watches?
We do, but this man wears a hunting horn.
Mormont pointed at Arthur.
"Must I suppose that he died without sounding it? Or have your rangers all gone deaf as well as blind?"
Sir Jeremy bristled, his face taunt with anger.
"No horn was blown, my lord, or my rangers would have heard it. I do not have sufficient men to mount as many patrols as I should like, and since Benjen was lost we have stayed closer to the wall than we were wont to do before, by your own command."
The old bear grunted.
"Yes, well, be that as it may."
He made an impatient gesture.
"Tell me how they died."
Squatting beside the dead man he had named Jafer Flowers, Sir Jeremy grasped the head by the scalp. The hair came out between his fingers, brittle as straw. The knight cursed and shoved at the face with the heel of his hand. A great gash in the side of the corpse's neck opened like a mouth, crusted with dry blood. Only a few ropes of pale tendon still attached the head to the neck.
This was done with an axe.
"Oi," muttered Dywin, the old forester. "Belike the axe that Utter carried, me lord."
John could feel his breakfast churning in his belly, but he pressed his lips together and made himself look at the second body. Utter had been a big, ugly man, and he made a big, ugly corpse. No axe was in evidence. John remembered Arthur. He had been the one bellowing the bawdy song as the rangers rode out. His singing days were done. His flesh was blanched white as milk. Everywhere but his hands. His hands were black like Japheth's. Blossoms of hard, cracked blood decorated the mortal wounds that covered him like a rash, breast and groin and throat. Yet his eyes were still open. They stared up at the sky, blue as sapphires. Sir Jeremy stood.
The wildlings have access too.
Mormont rounded on him.
So you believe this is Mance Raider's work, hm? This close to the wall?
Or who else, my lord?
John could have told him. He knew, they all knew. Yet no man of them would say the words.
The others are only a story, a tale to make children shiver. If they ever lived at all, they were gone 8,000 years.
Even the thought made him feel foolish. He was a man grown now, a black brother of the Night's Watch, not the boy who once sat at old Nan's feet with Bran and Rob and Arya. Yet Lord Commander Mormont gave a snort.
If Ben Stark had come under a wildling attack, a half-day's ride from Castle Black, he would return for more men, chase the killers through all seven hells, and brought me back their heads.
Unless he was slain as well, Sir Jeremy insisted.
The words hurt, even now. It had been so long it seemed folly to cling to the hope that Ben Stark was still alive. But Jon Snow was nothing if not stubborn.
It has been close on half a year since Benjen left us, my lord, Sir Jeremy went on. The forest is fast. The wildlings might have fallen on him anywhere. I'd wager these two were the last survivors of his party on their way back to us. But the enemy caught them before they could reach the safety of the wall. The corpses are still fresh. These men cannot have been dead more than a day.
No,
Samuel Tarly squeaked. John was startled. Sam's nervous, high-pitched voice was the last he would have expected to hear. The fat boy was frightened of the officers, and Sir Jeremy was not known for his patience.
I did not ask for your views, boy,
Riker said coldly. Let him speak, sir, John blurted. Mormont's eyes flicked from Sam to John and back again.
If the lad has something to say, I'll hear him. Come closer, boy. We can't see you behind those horses.
Sam edged past John and the Garrons, sweating profusely.
My lord, it can't be a day, or look, the blood.
Yes, Mormont growled impatiently. Blood? What of it?
He soils his small clothes at the sight of it,
Chet shouted out, and the rangers laughed. Sam mopped at the sweat on his brow.
You You can see where Ghost, John's direwolf, you can see where he tore off the man's hand. And yet, the stump hasn't bled. Look.
He waved a hand.
My father, Lord Randall, he made me watch him dress animals sometimes when, after...
Sam shook his head from side to side, his chins quivering. Now that he had looked at the bodies, he could not seem to look away.
A fresh kill, the blood would still flow, my lords. Later, it would be clotted like a jelly, thick and...
He looks as if he was going to be sick.
This man, look at the wrist, it's all crusty, dry, like...
John saw at once what Sam meant. He could see the torn veins in the dead man's wrist, iron worms in the pale flesh. His blood was a black dust, yet Jeremy Riker was unconvinced.
If they'd been dead much longer than a day, they'd be ripe by now, boy. They don't even smell.
Dywin, the gnarled old forester, who'd like to boast that he could smell snow coming on, sidled closer to the corpses and took a whiff.
Well, there are no pansy flowers, but my lord has the truth of it. There's no corpse stink.
They are rotting,
Sam pointed, his fat finger shaking only a little.
Look, there's no maggots or worms or anything. They've been lying here in the woods, but they haven't been chewed or eaten by animals. Only ghosts. Otherwise, they're...
Untouched, John said softly. And Ghost is different. The dogs and the horses won't go near them. The rangers exchanged glances. They could see it was true. Every man of them. Mormont frowned, glancing from the corpses to the dogs.
Chet, bring the hounds closer.
Chet tried, cursing, yanking on the leashes, giving one animal a lick of his boot. Most of the dogs just whimpered and planted their feet. He tried dragging one. The bitch resisted, growling and squirming as if to escape her collar. Finally, she lunged at him. Chet dropped the leash and stumbled backwards. The dog leapt over him and bounded off into the trees.
This is all wrong, Sam Tarley said earnestly. The blood, there's bloodstains on the clothes and their flesh, dry and hard, but there's none on the ground or anywhere. With those...
Sam made himself swallow, took a deep breath.
With those wounds, terrible wounds, there should be blood all over, shouldn't there?
Dywin sucked at his wooden teeth.
Might be they didn't die here. Might be someone brought them and left them for us. A warning, as like.
The old forester peered down suspiciously.
And might be I'm a fool, but I don't know that Uther never had no blue eyes afore.
Sir Jeremy looked startled.
Neither do flowers,
he blurted, turning to stare at the dead man. A silence fell over the wood. For a moment, all they heard was Sam's heavy breathing and the wet sound of Dywin sucking on his teeth. John squatted beside Ghost.
Burn them, someone whispered.
One of the rangers. John could not have said who.
Yes, burn them,
a second voice urged. The old bear gave a stubborn shake of his head.
Not yet. I want Maester Aemon to look at them. We'll bring them back to the wall.
Some commands are more easily given than obeyed. They wrapped the dead men in cloaks, but when Hake and Dywin tried to tie one onto a horse, the animal went mad, screaming and rearing, lashing out with its hooves, even biting at Ketter when he ran to help. The rangers had no better luck with the other Garrons. Not even the most placid wanted any part of these burdens. In the end, they were forced to hack off branches and fashion crude slings to carry the corpses back on foot. It was well past midday by the time they started back. "I will have these woods searched," Mormont commanded Sir Jeremy as they set out. "Every tree, every rock, every bush, and every foot of muddy ground within 10 leagues of here. Use all the men you have, and if you do not have enough, borrow hunters and foresters from the Stuarts. If Ben and the others are out there, dead or alive, I will have them found. And if there is anyone else in these woods, I will know of it. You are to track them and take them, alive if possible. Is that understood?"
"It is, my lord," Sir Jeremy said. "It will be done."
After that, Mormont rode in silence, brooding. John followed close behind him. As the Lord Commander Stuart, that was his place. The day was grey, damp, overcast, the sort of day that made you wish for rain. No wind stirred the wood. The air hung humid and heavy, and John's clothes clung to his skin. It was warm, too warm. The wall was weeping copiously, had been weeping for days, and sometimes John even imagined it was shrinking. The old men called this weather Spirit Summer, and said it meant the season was giving up its ghosts at last. After this, the cold would come, they warned. And a long summer always meant a long winter. The summer had lasted 10 years. John had been a babe in arms when it began. Ghost ran with them for a time, and then vanished among the trees. Without the direwolf, John felt almost naked. He found himself glancing at every shadow with unease. Unbidden, he thought back to the tales that old Nan used to tell them when he was a boy at Winterfell. He could almost hear her voice again, and the click, click, click of her needles.
"In that darkness, the others come riding," she used to say, dropping her voice lower and lower. "Cold and dead they were, and they hated iron and fire and the touch of the sun, and every living creature with hot blood in its veins, holdfasts and cities, and kingdoms of men all fell before them as they moved south on pale dead horses, leading hosts of the slain. They fed their dead servants on the flesh of human children."
When he caught his first glimpse of the wall, looming above the tops of an ancient gnarled oak, John was vastly relieved. Mormont reined up suddenly and turned in his saddle. "Tarly," he barked, "come here." John saw the start of fright on Sam's face as he lumbered up on his mare. Doubtless, he thought, he was in trouble.
"You're fat, but you're not stupid, boy," the old bear said gruffly. "You did well back there. And you, Snow."
Sam blushed a vivid crimson and tripped over his own tongue as he tried to stammer out a courtesy. John had to smile. When they emerged from under the trees, Mormont spurred his tough little Garen to a trot. Ghost came streaking out of the woods to meet them, licking his chops, his muzzle red from prey. High above, the men on the wall saw the column approaching. John heard the deep, throaty call of the watchman's great horn, calling out across the miles, a single long blast that shuddered through the trees and echoed off the ice. The sound faded slowly to silence. One blast meant rangers returning, and John thought, "I was a ranger, for one day at least. Whatever may come, they can't take that away from me." Bowen Marsh was waiting at the first gate as they led the Garrons through the icy tunnel. The Lord Stuart was red-faced and agitated. "My lord," he blurted at Mormont as he swung open the iron bars, there's been a bird. You must come at once."
"What is it, man?" Mormont said gruffly.
Curiously, Marsh glanced at John before he answered.
Maester Aemon has a letter. He's waiting in your cella. Very well, John. See to my horse and tell Sir Jeremy to put the dead men in a storeroom until the maester is ready for them. Mormont strode away, grumbling. As they led their horses back to the stable, John was uncomfortably aware that people were watching him. Sir Alistair Thorne was drilling his boys in the yard, but he broke off to stare at John, a faint half-smile on his lips. One-armed Donald Noy stood in the door of the armory. "The gods be with you, Snow," he called out.
"Something's wrong," John thought. "Something's very wrong."
The dead men were carried to one of the storerooms along the base of the wall, a dark coal cell chiselled from the ice and used to keep meat and grain and sometimes even beer. John saw the Mormont's horse was fed and watered and groomed before he took care of his own. Afterwards he sought out his friends. Gren and Toad were on watch, but he found Pip in the common hall. "What's happened?" he asked. Pip lowered his voice.
"The king's dead." John was stunned. Robert Baratheon had looked old and fat when he visited Winterfell, yet he seemed hale enough, and there had been no talk of illness. "How can you know?"
"One of the guards, Overeer Clidas, reading the letter to Maester Aemon."
Pip leaned close.
"John, I'm sorry. He was your father's friend, wasn't he?"
They were as close as brothers once. John wondered if Joffrey would keep his father as the king's hand. It did not seem likely. That might mean Lord Eddard would return to Winterfell, and his sisters as well. He might even be allowed to visit them with Lord Mormont's permission. It would be good to see Arya's grin again and to talk with his father.
"I will ask him about my mother," he resolved. "I'm a man now. It's past time, he told me. Even if she was a whore, I don't care. I want to know."
"I heard Ake say the dead men were your uncles," Pip said.
"Yes," John replied. "Two of the six he took with him. They've been dead a long time, only the bodies are queer."
"Queer?"
Pip was all curiosity.
"How queer?"
"Sam will tell you." John did not want to talk of it. "I should see if the old bear has need of me." He walked to the Lord Commander's tower alone with a curious sense of apprehension. The brothers on guard eyed him solemnly as he approached.
"The old bear's in his solar," one of them announced. "He was asking for you."
John nodded. He should have come straight from the stable. He climbed the tower steps briskly. "He wants wine, or a fire in his hearth, that's all," he told himself. When he entered the solar, Mormont's raven screamed at him.
"Corn!"
the bird shrieked.
"Corn! Corn! Corn!"
"Don't you believe it, I just fed him," the old bear growled.
He was seated by the window reading a letter.
"Bring me a cup of wine and pour one for yourself."
"For myself, my lord."
Mormont lifted his eyes from the letter to stare at John. There was pity in that look. He could taste it.
"You heard me."
John poured with exaggerated care, vaguely aware that he was drawing out the act. When the cups were filled, he would have no choice but to face whatever was in that letter. Yet all too soon they were filled.
"Sit, boy," Mormont commanded him. "Drink."
John remained standing. "It's my father, isn't it?" The old bear tapped the letter with a finger.
"Your father and the king," he rumbled. "I won't lie to you. It's grievous news. I never thought to see another king, not at my age, with Robert half my years and strong as a bull."
He took a gulp of wine.
"They say the king loved to hunt. The things we love destroy us every time, lad. Remember that. My son loved that young wife of his, vain woman. If not for her, he would never have thought to sell those poachers."
John could scarcely follow what he was saying. "My lord, I don't understand. What's happened to my father?"
"I told you to sit," Mormont grumbled.
"Sit,"
the raven screeched.
"And have a drink, damn you. That's a command, Snow."
John sat and took a sip of wine.
Lord Edard has been imprisoned. He's charged with treason. It is said he plotted with Robert's brothers to deny the throne to Prince Joffrey.
No, John said at once, that couldn't be. My father would never betray the king.
Be that as it may, said Mormont. It's not for me to say, nor for you.
But it's a lie, John insisted. How could they think his father was a traitor? Had they all gone mad? Lord Eddard Stark would never dishonour himself. Would he?
He fathered a bastard, a small voice whispered inside him. Where was the honour in that? And your mother? What of her? He will not even speak her name.
My lord, what will happen to him? Will they kill him?
Well, as to that, I cannot say, lad. I mean to send a letter. I knew some of the king's counsellors in my youth. Old Pycelle, Lord Stannis, Sir Barristan. Whatever your father has done, or hasn't done, he is a great lord. He must be allowed to take the black and join us here. Gods know we need men of Lord Eddard's ability.
John knew that other men accused of treason had been allowed to redeem their honour on the wall in days past. Why not Lord Eddard, his father here? That was a strange thought, and strangely uncomfortable. It would be a monstrous injustice to strip him of Winterfell and force him to take the black. And yet, if it meant his life, and would Joffrey allow it? He remembered the prince at Winterfell, the way he'd mocked Rob and Sir Roderick in the yard. John himself he had scarcely even noticed. Bastards were beneath even his contempt. My lord, will the king listen to you? The old bear shrugged.
A boy king. I imagine he'll listen to his mother. Pity the dwarf isn't with them. He's the lad's uncle, and he saw our need when he visited us. It was a bad thing. Your lady mother taking him captive.
Lady Stark is not my mother, John reminded him sharply. Tyrion Lannister had been a friend to him. If Lord Eddard was killed, she would be as much to blame as a queen. My lord, what of my sisters, Arya and Sansa? They were with my father. Do you know...
Pycelle makes a mention of them, but doubtless they'll be treated gently. I will ask about them when I write.
Mormont shook his head.
This could not have happened at a worse time, if ever the realm needed a strong king. There are dark days and cold nights ahead. I feel it in my bones.
He gave John a long, shrewd look.
I hope you're not thinking of doing anything stupid, boy.
He's my father, John wanted to say, but he knew that Mormont would not want to hear it. His throat was dry. He made himself take another sip of wine.
Your duty is here now, the Lord Commander reminded him. Your old life ended when you took the black.
His bird made a raucous echo.
Black!
Mormont took no notice.
Whatever they do in King's Landing is none of our concern.
When John did not answer, the old man finished his wine and said,
You're free to go. I'll have no further need of you today. On the morrow, you can help me write that letter.
John did not remember standing or leaving the solar. The next he knew, he was descending the tower steps thinking, This is my father, my sisters. How can it be none of my concern? Outside, one of the guards looked at him and said,
Be strong, boy. The guards are cruel.
They know, John realized.
My father is no traitor, he said hoarsely.
Even the words stuck in his throat as if to choke him. The wind was rising, and it seemed colder in the yard than it had when he'd gone in. Spirit summer was drawing to an end. The rest of the afternoon passed as if in a dream. John could not have said where he walked, what he did, who he spoke with. Ghost was with him. He knew that much. The silent presence of the direwolf gave him comfort. The girls do not even have that much, he thought. Their walls might have kept them safe. But Lady is dead, and Nymeria is lost. They're all alone. A north wind had begun to blow by the time the sun went down. John could hear it skirling against the wall and over the icy battlements as he went to the common hall for the evening meal. Hob had cooked up a venison stew, thick with barley, onions and carrots. When he spooned an extra portion onto John's plate and gave him the crusty heel of the bread, he knew what it meant.
He knows.
He looked around the hall, saw heads turned quickly, eyes politely averted.
They all know.
His friends rallied to him.
"We asked the Septon to light a candle for your father," Mather told him.
"It's a lie. We all know it's a lie. Even Gren knows it's a lie,"
Pip chimed in. Gren nodded, and Sam clasped John's hand.
"You're my brother now, so he's my father too," the fat boy said. "If you want to go out to the weirwoods and pray to the old gods, I'll go with you."
The weirwoods were beyond the wall, yet he knew Sam meant what he said.
"They are my brothers," he thought, "as much as Rob and Bran and Rickon."
And then he heard the laughter, sharp and cruel as a whip, and the voice of Sir Alistair Thorne.
"Not only a bastard, but a traitor's bastard,"
he was telling the men around him. In the blink of an eye, John had vaulted onto the table, dagger in his hand. Pip made a grab for him, but he wrenched his leg away, and then he was sprinting down the table and kicking the bowl from Sir Alice's hand. Stew went flying everywhere, spattering the brothers. Thorne recoiled. People were shouting, but John Snow did not hear them. He lunged at Sir Alice's face with a dagger, slashing at those cold onyx eyes. But Sam threw himself between them, and before John could get around him, Pip was on his back, clinging like a monkey, and Gren was grabbing his arm while Toad wrenched the knife from his fingers. Later, much later, after they had marched him back to his sleeping cell, Mormont came down to see him, Raven on his shoulder.
"I told you not to do anything stupid, boy," the old bear said.
"Oi!"
the bird chorused. Mormont shook his head, disgusted.
"And to think I had high hopes for you."
They took his knife and his sword and told him he was not to leave his cell until the high officers met to decide what was to be done with him. And then they placed a guard outside his door to make certain he obeyed. His friends were not allowed to see him, but the old bear did relent and permit him Ghost, so he was not utterly alone.
"My father is no traitor,"
he told the direwolf when the rest had gone. Ghost looked at him in silence. John slumped against the wall, hands around his knees, and stared at the candle on the table beside his narrow bed. The flame flickered and swayed. The shadows moved around him. The room seemed to grow darker and colder.
"I will not sleep tonight," John thought.
Yet he must have dozed. When he woke, his legs were stiff and cramped, and the candle had long since burned out. Ghost stood on his hind legs, scrabbling at the door. John was startled to see how tall he'd grown. "Ghost, what is it?" he called softly. The direwolf turned his head and looked down at him, baring his fangs in a silent snarl.
"Has he gone mad?" John wondered.
"It's me, Ghost," he murmured, trying not to sound afraid. Yet he was trembling violently. When had it gotten so cold? Ghost backed away from the door. There were deep gouges where he'd rake the wood. John watched him with mounting disquiet.
"There's someone out there, isn't there?" he whispered.
Crouching, the dire wolf crept backward, white fur rising on the back of his neck.
"The guard," he thought. "They left a man to guard my door. Ghost smells him through the door. That's all it is."
Slowly, John pushed himself to his feet. He was shivering, uncontrollably, wishing he still had a sword. Three quick steps brought him to the door. He grabbed the handle and pulled it inward. The creak of the hinges almost made him jump. His guard was sprawled bonelessly across the narrow steps, looking up at him, even though he was lying on his stomach. His head had been twisted completely around.
"It can't be," John told himself.
This is the Lord Commander's tower. It's guarded day and night. This couldn't happen. It's a dream. I'm having a nightmare.
Ghost slid past him out of the door. The wolf started up the steps, stopped, looked back at John. That was when he heard it. The soft scrape of a boot on stone. The sound of a latch turning. The sounds came from above, from the Lord Commander's chambers. A nightmare this might be, yet it was no dream. The guard's sword was in its sheath. John knelt and worked it free. The heft of steel in his fist made him bolder. He moved up the steps, Ghost padding silently before him. Shadows lurked in every turn of the stair. John crept up warily, probing any suspicious darkness with the point of his sword. Suddenly he heard the shriek of Mormont's raven.
Gorn!
The bird was screaming.
Gorn! 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 Gorn!
Ghost bounded ahead, and John came scrambling after. The door to Mormont's solar was wide open. The direwolf plunged through. John stopped in the doorway, blade in hand, giving his eyes a moment to adjust. Heavy drapes had been pulled across the windows, and the darkness was black as ink. "Who's there?" he called out. Then he saw it, a shadow in the shadows, sliding towards the inner door that led to Mormont's sleeping cell. A man shape, all in black, cloaked and hooded. But beneath the hood, the eyes shone with an icy blue radiance. Ghost leapt. Man and wolf went down together, with neither scream nor snarl, rolling, smashing into a chair, knocking over a table laden with papers. Mormont's raven was flapping overhead, screaming,
"Gorn! Gorn! Gorn! Gorn!"
John felt as blind as Maester Aemon. Keeping the wall to his back, he slid toward the window and ripped down the curtain. Moonlight flooded the solar. He glimpsed black hands buried in white fur, swollen dark fingers tightening around his direwolf's throat. Ghost was twisting and snapping, legs flailing in the air, but he could not break free. John had no time to be afraid. He threw himself forward, shouting, bringing down the longsword with all his weight behind it. Steel sheared through sleeve and skin and bone. Yet the sound was wrong somehow. The smell that engulfed him was so queer and cold he almost gagged. He saw arm and hand on the floor, black fingers wriggling in a pool of moonlight. Ghost wrenched free from the other hand and crept away, red tongue lolling from his mouth. The hooded man lifted his pale moon face, and John slashed at it without hesitation. The sword laid the intruder open to the bone, taking off half his nose and opening a gash cheek to cheek under those eyes. Eyes. Eyes like blue stars burning. John knew that face. Arthur, he thought, reeling back. Gods, he's dead, he's dead. I saw him dead. He felt something scrabble at his ankle. Black fingers clawed at his calf. The arm was crawling up his leg, ripping at wool and flesh. Shouting with revulsion, John pried the fingers off his leg with the point of his sword and flipped the thing away. It lay writhing, fingers opening and closing. The corpse lurched forward. There was no blood. One-armed, face cut near in half, it seemed to feel nothing. John held the longsword before him. "Stay away!" he commanded, his voice gone shrill.
"Gorn!"
screamed the raven.
"Gorn! Gorn!"
The severed arm was wriggling out of its torn sleeve, a pale snake with black five-fingered head. Ghost pounced and got it between his teeth. Finger bones crunched. John hacked at the corpse's neck, felt the steel bite deep and hard. Dead Arthur slammed into him, knocking him off his feet. John's breath went out of him as the fallen table caught him between his shoulder blades.
The sword. Where was the sword? He'd lost the damn sword. When he opened his mouth to scream, the white jammed its black corpse fingers into John's mouth. Gagging, he tried to shove it off, but the dead man was too heavy, its hand forcing itself farther down his throat, icy cold, choking him. Its face was against his own, filling the world. Frost covered its eyes, sparkling blue. John raked cold flesh with his nails and kicked at the thing's legs. He tried to bite, tried to punch, tried to breathe. And suddenly, the corpse's weight was gone. Its fingers ripped from his throat. It was all John could do to roll over, retching and shaking. Ghost had it again. He watched as the direwolf buried his teeth in the white's gut and began to rip and tear. He watched, only half-conscious, for a long moment, before he finally remembered to look for his sword. And saw Lord Mormont, naked and groggy from sleep, standing in the doorway with an oil lamp in his hand. Gnawed and fingerless, the arm thrashed on the floor, wriggling toward him. John tried to shout, but his voice was gone. Staggering to his feet, he kicked the arm away and snatched the lamp from the old bear's fingers. The flame flickered and almost died. "Burn!" the raven called. "Burn! Burn! Burn!" Spinning, John saw the drapes he'd ripped from the window. He flung the lamp into the puddled cloth with both hands. Metal crunched, glass shattered, oil spewed, and the hangings went up in a great whoosh of flame. The heat of it on his face was sweeter than any kiss John had ever known. "Ghost!" he shouted. The direwolf wrenched free and came to him as the white struggled to rise, dark snakes spilling from the great wound in its belly. John plunged his hand into the flames, grabbed a fistful of the burning drapes, and whipped them at the dead man. "Let it burn," he prayed, as the cloth smothered the corpse. "Gods, please, please let it burn."
Sansa. The southern sky was black with smoke. It rose, swirling off 100 distant fires, its sooty fingers smudging out the stars. Across the Blackwater Rush, a line of flame burned nightly from horizon to horizon, while on this side the imp had fired the whole riverfront, docks and warehouses, homes and brothels, everything outside the city walls. Even in the Red Keep, the air tasted of ashes. When Sansa found Ser Dontos in the quiet of the Guardswood, he asked if she'd been crying. "It's only from the smoke," she lied. "It looks as if half the Kingswood is burning."
"Lord Stannis wants to smoke out the imp savages," Dontos swayed as he spoke, one hand on the trunk of a chestnut tree. A wine stain discolored the red and yellow motley of his tunic. "They kill his scouts and raid his baggage train, and the wildlings have been lighting fires too. The imp told the queen that Stannis had better train his horses to eat ash, since he would find no blade of grass." "I heard him say so. I hear all sorts of things, as a fool, that I never heard when I was a knight. They talk as though I'm not there, and..."
He leaned close, breathing his whiny breath right in her face.
"The spider pays in gold for any little trifle. I think Moonboy has been his for years."
"He is drunk again. My poor Florian, he names himself, and so he is. But he is all I have. Is it true that Lord Stannis burned the God's Wood at Storm's End?" Dontos nodded.
"He made a great pyre of the trees as an offering to his new god. The Red Priestess made him do it. They say she rules him now, body and soul. He's vowed to burn the great sept of Baelor, too, if he takes the city."
"Let him." When Sansa had first beheld the great sept, with its marble walls and seven crystal towers, She thought it was the most beautiful building in the world. But that had been before Joffrey beheaded her father on its steps. I want it burned.
Hush, child. The gods will hear you.
Why should they? They never hear my prayers.
Yes, they do. They sent me to you, didn't they?
Sansa picked at the bark of a tree. She felt light-headed, almost feverish. They sent you, but what good have you done? You promised you would take me home, but I'm still here. Dantos patted her arm.
I've spoken to a certain man I know, a good friend of me, and to you, my lady. He will hire a swift ship to take us to safety, when the time is right.
The time is right now, Sansa insisted, before the fighting starts. They've forgotten about me. I know we could slip away if we tried.
Child, child, Dantos shook his head. Out of the castle, yes, we could do that. But the city gates are more heavily guarded than ever. And the imp has even closed off the river.
It was true. The Blackwater Rush was as empty as Sansa had ever seen it. All the ferries had been withdrawn to the north bank, and the trading galleys had fled, all been seized by the imp to be made over for battle. The only ships to be seen were the king's war galleys. They rowed endlessly up and down, staying to the deep water in the middle of the river, and exchanging flights of arrows with Stannis's archers on the south shore. Lord Stannis himself was still on the march, but his vanguard had appeared 2 nights ago during the Black of the Moon. King's Landing had woken to the sight of their tents and banners. They were 5,000, Sansa had heard, near as many as all the gold cloaks in the city. They flew the red or green apples of House Fossoway, the turtle of Estamont, and the fox and flowers of Florent, and their commander was Sir Gaillard Morrigan, a famous southern knight whom men now called Gaillard the Green. His standard showed a crow in flight, its black wings spread wide against a storm-green sky. But it was the pale yellow banners that worried the city. Long, ragged tails streamed behind them like flickering flames, and in place of a lord's sigil, they bore the device of a god, the burning heart of the Lord of Light. When Stannis comes, he'll have 10 times as many men as Joffrey does. Everyone says so. Dantos squeezed her shoulder.
The size of his host does not matter, sweetling, so long as they are on the wrong side of the river. Stannis cannot cross without ships.
He has ships, more than Joffrey.
It's a long sail from Storm's End. The fleet will need to come up Massey's Hook and through the Gullet and across Blackwater Bay. Perhaps the good gods will send a storm to sweep them from the seas.
Dantos gave a hopeful smile.
It's not easy for you, I know. You must be patient, child. When my friend returns to the city, we shall have our ship. Have faith in your Florian, and try not to be afraid.
Sansa dug her nails into her hand. She could feel the fear in her tummy, twisting and pinching, worse every day. Nightmares of the day Princess Myrcella had sailed still troubled her sleep. Dark, suffocating dreams that woke her in the black of night, struggling for breath. She could hear the people screaming at her, screaming without words like animals. They had hemmed her in and thrown filth at her and tried to pull her off her horse, and would have done worse if the hound had not cut his way to her side. They had torn the High Septon to pieces and smashed Sir Aaron's head with a rock. Try not to be afraid, he said. The whole city was afraid. Sansa could see it from the castle walls. The small folk were hiding themselves behind closed shutters and barred doors, as if that would keep them safe. The last time King's Landing had fallen, the Lannisters looted and raped as they pleased, and put hundreds to the sword, even though the city had opened its gates. This time the imp meant to fight, and a city that fought could expect no mercy at all. Dantos was prattling on.
If I were still a knight, I should have put on armour and manned the walls with the rest. I ought to kiss King Joffrey's feet and thank him sweetly.
If you thanked him for making you a fool, he'd make you a knight again, Sansa said sharply. Dantos chuckled.
My Junkle's a clever girl, isn't she?
Joffrey and his mother say I'm stupid.
Let them. You're safer that way, sweetling. Queen Cersei and the imp and Lord Varys and their like. They all watch each other, keen as hawks, and pay this one and that one to spy out what the others are doing. But no one ever troubles themselves over Lady Tander's daughter, do they?
Dantos covered his mouth to stifle a burp.
God preserve you, my little Junkle.
He was growing weepy. The wine did that to him.
Give me a florin little kiss now. A kiss for luck.
He swayed toward her. Sansa dodged the wet, groping lips, kissed him lightly on an unshaven cheek, and bid him good night. It took all her strength not to weep. She had been weeping too much of late. It was unseemly, she knew, but she could not seem to help herself. The tears would come, sometimes over a trifle, and nothing she did could hold them back. The drawbridge to Maegor's holdfast was unguarded. The imp had moved most of the gold cloaks to the city walls, and the white knights of the King's Guard had duties more important than dodging her heels. Sansa could go where she would, so long as she did not try to leave the castle, but there was nowhere she wanted to go. She crossed over the dry moat with its cruel iron spikes and made her way up the narrow turnpike stair. But when she reached the door of her bedchamber, she could not bear to enter. The very walls of the room made her feel trapped. Even with the window open wide, it felt as though there was no air to breathe. Turning back to the stair, Sansa climbed. The smoke blotted out the stars and the thin crescent of moon. So the roof was dark and thick with shadows. Yet from here she could see everything. The Red Keep's tall towers and great corner forts, the maze of city streets beyond, to south and west, the river running black, the bay to the east, the columns of smoke and cinders, and fires, fires everywhere. Soldiers crawling over the city walls like ants with torches, and crowded the hoardings that had sprouted from the ramparts. Down by the mud gate, outlined against the drifting smoke, she could make out the vague shape of the three huge catapults, the biggest anyone had ever seen, overtopping the walls by a good 20 feet. Yet none of it made her feel less fearful. A stab went through her, so sharp that Sansa sobbed and clutched at her belly. She might have fallen, but a shadow moved suddenly, and strong fingers grabbed her arm and steadied her. She grabbed a merlon for support, her fingers scrabbling at the rough stone. "Let go, miss," she cried. "Let go!"
"The little bird thinks she has wings, does she? Or do you mean to end up crippled, like that brother of yours?"
Sansa twisted in his grip. "I wasn't going to fall. I was only... You startled me, that's all."
"You mean I scared you? And still do."
She took a deep breath to calm herself. "I thought I was alone. She glanced away.
"The little bird still can't bear to look at me, can she?"
The hound released her.
"You were glad enough to see my face when the mob had you, though. Remember?"
Sansa remembered all too well. She remembered the way they had howled, the feel of the blood running down her cheek from where the stone had struck her, and the garlic stink on the breath of the man who had tried to pull her from her horse. She could still feel the cruel pinch of fingers on her wrist as she lost her balance and began to fall. She thought she was going to die then. But the fingers had twitched, all five at once, and the man had shrieked loud as a horse. When his hand fell away, another hand, stronger, shoved her back into her saddle. The man with the garlicky breath was on the ground, blood pumping out of the stump of his arm. But there were others all around, some with clubs in hand. The hound leapt at them, his sword a blur of steel that trailed a red mist as it swung. When they broke and ran before him, he had laughed, his terrible, burned face for a moment transformed. She made herself look at that face now, really look. It was only courteous, and a lady must never forget her courtesies. The scars are not the worst part, nor even the way his mouth twitches. It's his eyes. She had never seen eyes so full of anger. I should have come to you after, she said haltingly, to thank you for saving me. You were so brave.
Brave?
His laugh was half a snarl. A dog doesn't need courage to chase off rats. They had me 30-1, and not a man of them dared face me. She hated the way he talked, always so harsh and angry. Does it give you joy to scare people?
No, it gives me joy to kill people.
His mouth twitched.
Wrinkle up your face all you like, but spare me this false piety. You and I, lords, get. Don't tell me Lord Eddard Stark of Winterfell never killed a man.
That was his duty. He never liked it.
Is that what he told you? Clegane laughed again. Your father lied. Killing is the sweetest thing there is.
He drew his longsword.
Here's your truth. Your precious father found that out on Baelor's steps. Lord of Winterfell, and the king, warden of the north, the mighty Eddard Stark, of a line 8,000 years old. But Ilion Payne's blade went through his neck all the same, didn't it? Do you remember the dance he did when his head came off his shoulders?
Sansa hugged herself, suddenly cold. Why are you always so hateful? I was thanking you.
Just as if I was one of those true knights you love so well, yes. What do you think a knight is for, girl? You think it's all taking favours from ladies and looking fine in gold plate? Knights are for killing.
He laid the edge of his longsword against her neck, just under her ear. Sansa could feel the sharpness of the steel.
I killed my first man at 12. I've lost count of how many I've killed since then. High lords with old names, fat rich men dressed in velvet, knights puffed up like bladders with their honours, yes, and women, and children too. They're all meat, and I'm the butcher. Let them have their lands, and their guards, and their gold. Let them have their sirs.
Sandor Clegane spat at her feet to show what he thought of that.
So long as I have this,
he said, lifting the sword from her throat,
there's no man on earth I need fear.
Except your brother, Sansa thought, but she had better sense than to say it aloud. He is a dog, just as he says. A half-wild, mean-tempered dog that bites any hand that tries to pet him, and yet will savage any man who tries to hurt his masters. Not even the men across the river? Clegane's eyes turned toward the distant fires.
All this burning.
He sheathed his sword.
Only cowards fight with fire.
Lord Stannis is no coward.
He's not the man his brother was either. Robert never let a little thing like a river stop him.
What will you do when he crosses it?
Fight, kill, die maybe.
Aren't you afraid? The guards might send you down to some terrible hell for all the evil you've done.
What evil?
He laughed.
What gods?
The gods who made us all.
All? He mocked. Tell me, little bird, what kind of god makes a monster like the imp, or a half-wit like Lady Tanda's daughter? If there are gods, they made sheep so wolves could eat mutton, and they made the weak for the strong to play with.
True knights protect the weak.
Tchah!
He snorted.
There are no true knights, no more than there are gods. If you can't protect yourself, die and get out of the way of those who can. Sharp steel and strong arms rule this world. Don't ever believe any different.
Sansa backed away from him. You're awful.
I'm honest. It's the world that's awful. Now fly away, little bird. I'm sick of you peeping at me.
Wordless, she fled. She was afraid of Sandor Clegane, and yet Some part of her wished that Sir Dantas had a little of the hound's ferocity. There are gods, she told herself, and there are